The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I think the sound is not working. Maybe Anika needs to go up louder. So let's see. There, are we getting there now?
Yeah.
So that's probably a little bit too loud now. So it's going to start ringing. So it needs to be a little bit lower. So let's see. How's this now? Does it work? Okay. And it's possible that the sound is not, the speakers are not working in the outer hall, but it's very well, so. Okay. So, I would like to tell you an allegory that comes from this ancient Buddhist texts, purportedly back to the time of the Buddha. And it goes this way, that deep in the, not deep, but I guess the way it works is maybe in the Himalayas, the Buddha lived, was born in the foothills of the Himalayas, lived in the plains. So that whole territory was kind of from the plains up into the mountains was known by him. So he said that there are places up in the mountains where it's really steep, lots of crags and canyons, and where it's dangerous for people to go, and it's also dangerous for monkeys to go. You come down closer to the plains, there's places where there's forests, and still it's a little bit steep, and there it's dangerous for people to go, but it's not dangerous for monkeys. And then he said, if you go further down to the plains where it's more open, well, both monkeys and people can go there. However, if the monkeys don't stay in that intermediate zone where people can't go and go to where people can go, then there are monkey hunters. And those monkey hunters, apparently one technique for catching monkeys in ancient India is you put some kind of trap down on the ground that has some kind of pitch or tar. And if the monkey puts its hand in the tar, the pitch, it gets stuck. Well, then it's going to go and take its other hand to try to push itself free, and then the other hand gets stuck. And then it wants to take its feet to push out, and both feet get stuck. But it really wants to get free, so the only thing that's free to do anything is the head. So it bends down to push its head, try to free itself from the tar, and it just can't. And the hunter comes along and just somehow is able to pick up the monkey, and the monkey's caught. So the Buddha said that if the monkey had stayed in its ancestral homeland, which was an intermediate zone where people, too dangerous for people to go, but fine for monkeys to be, the monkeys would have been safe from people, safe from the traps that were set for them. The same way, he said, people should stay in their own ancestral homeland. Because if you leave your ancestral homeland, there will be traps for you. And just like getting the monkeys got stuck with all their five, hands, legs, feet, and heads, we'll get stuck in these things. And the thing that he tells us to get stuck in is the sensual objects of the world, and the sense objects of the world. So it's not just sensual pleasures, it's just like all kinds of things that we want to have and the things of the world, addictions and attachments people have. And some people get attached to these things, and it's so unpleasant, the very effort to get free, they get themselves more attached. They want more things or better things or something. I don't know how it works. But the main point I wanted to tell the story about is that the Buddha said, you're safe if you stay in your ancestral homeland. And then the question is, what is the ancestral homeland for human beings? Where is the intermediate place that's safe to be? And then he explained that that is the what normally is called the four foundations of mindfulness. There's something about staying, abiding in a field of awareness, in our attention, in a particular way, which if you do that, you're less likely to get caught in the traps that the world has to offer. And you can kind of fill in what all the traps are we get caught in. And but then he says, this is our ancestral homeland. Like, that's a kind of interesting idea, that somehow here in the field of our attention, our attentional capacities of mindfulness, of awareness, that that can be kind of a homeland for us, a home for us, that we can dwell in, and that it's ancestral, primordial, I don't know how you want to call it, that it has this kind of ancient value. It's like the place where we can be safe, a place that's a home, a place that's been kind of maybe the primary birthplace for us to dwell in, or something like that. So the four foundations of mindfulness is how most people know these terms. Nowadays, so this is the idea of mindfulness. So I want to talk a little bit about these four foundations of mindfulness, because they're kind of like the core teachings that the Buddha had for mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice these days is quite popular in the West in some circles. There's all these clinical applications of mindfulness, and what's often, at least the Buddhists call it, secular mindfulness being offered in many different settings. It's all very great that's happening this way. And but the way that mindfulness is being taught, both in secular places, but also in a lot of Buddhist teachers, is often not very similar to what the Buddha was teaching. And what the Buddha had was particular and very focused in some ways on how we use mindfulness, how we use attention. And I think that the purpose for that focus, or that kind of specificity that he had, is to help with the safety, to be a place where we can live and dwell, really feel like it's a home for us, and so that we can be safe and some. So the four foundations of mindfulness. The first thing I want to say is the word for mindfulness is sati, S-A-T-I. And that word, nowadays there's a certain momentum by some Buddhist scholars, Buddhist meditation masters, to no longer translate it as mindfulness, but to translate it as awareness. And I think some of that motivation is that we've lost control of the word. It's out there in the world. It has all these different meanings. But also, many times the way that it's used is not quite how the Buddha used it. And it's a much more complex kind of idea. Whereas mindfulness in the Buddhist teachings is much closer to what we would think of as awareness. Because it's something that we can dwell in, abide in, something we can establish. And the mindfulness is understood to be an active cognitive process where we actively engage the mind and do it, do mindfulness. That's not how the Buddha talked about sati. Sati isn't something you do, it's more like something you are. And you dwell in this thing that you are. So it's a natural functioning of our system, or of our human attentional systems, that is operating, you could say, all the time. There's always some form of awareness going on. And even if you don't want to be aware, if I told you stop being aware, cut it out, you probably, if you're paying attention to me, you probably couldn't cut it out, right? It wouldn't work. And it's just that's what the system wants to do, is to be aware. And so rather than engaging this awareness and doing it, the idea is to, as an activity or a doing, it's more something, in Buddhist language, we abide in modern language, like some people say, rest in this awareness. One Bhikkhu Bodhi, who translates a lot of these suttas, in some of his modern works, he translates this as sati as lucid awareness. And I like the word, you know, it kind of adds a kind of quality to it, lucid awareness, as opposed to just the, I don't know, garden variety awareness that some of us walk around in most of the time, but lucid awareness, that's pretty cool. And this expression, the four foundations of mindfulness, rather than calling it that, nowadays there's a movement to call it the four establishments of mindfulness. And, you know, it's a little bit bad English, four establishments of mindfulness, I think. But the way I understand it, and how I like to translate it now, is the four ways of establishing awareness. So there's four ways, four practices you can do that can establish this lucid awareness, establish this strong awareness that we can rest in, abide in. That can be our home, which is, you know, from some people is a very nice metaphor, the idea of being home, and be home in, and where we can be safe in, here in this place. So there's four ways of establishing this awareness. And these four are bringing attention to our physical experience, the body, bringing attention to our what's called the feelings, bringing attention to the states of our mind, and bringing attention to how the mind works, the operations of the mind. And so each of those can be taken separately. In fact, sometimes in the teachings of the Buddha, some of these are done separately, independently of the others. And the first one especially, this ancient tradition put a tremendous amount of attention on mindfulness of the body, or attention, awareness of the body. One of the reasons for it, maybe, is that our physical body houses a lot of our sensory apparatus, a lot of the ways in which we tune into the world, we interact with the world, take information from the world, participate in the world, react to the world, happens through our physical body. So if we're really attuned to our body, we're aware of a lot of what goes on, and much in a more heightened sense than if we are just in our heads. And I think it's fair to say that modern society, compared to ancient India 2,500 years ago, has a tremendous momentum for people to be not in their bodies compared to back then. There is, so many forces that keep us in our heads and our thoughts and our cognitive world. I mean, just these devices people are on, the screens people are on, are just, you know, some people spend hours and hours a day on them. But before there were computers, sometimes people spend a lot of time reading. And reading also is nice to do, for sure, but it also kind of can disconnect one to the body. And then there's psychological, emotional reasons, all kinds of reasons why people kind of become disembodied, disconnected to their body. That probably wasn't so common in the ancient world, because I think a lot of their work was physical. They were engaged in the work in a physical way. They didn't sit in cars and traffic. They had to walk. They walked everywhere pretty much. And so the idea of being in your body and then connecting to this attentional apparatus that's here in the body. So the Buddha, the first thing he says how to do that in this ancient text is that you begin bringing attention to your breathing. First he says you sit down, sit upright, and then establish your attention with your breathing, your body breathing. And you can tune into your breath for a while, get to know it, and then become aware of how there's tension in your body as you breathe, and then relax that tension. So the first thing to do is to relax. Relax the physical holding patterns in the body the best you can. And this is a very effective way of certainly coming into the body, but also to begin tuning into this vast sensory apparatus, all this information that's stored in the body. The more relaxed we are, the more the body becomes awake with sensations, awareness, becomes an antenna in a sense. And the more tense we are, the less the body is available for tuning into what's going on. When I was younger, if someone had asked me when I was maybe 20, where's your awareness? If I had to point to it, I would have pointed to my head. And at some point, after doing some years of practice, if someone had asked me where my awareness is, I would have pointed to my chest. And after some more years of practice, if someone had asked me where my awareness is, I would have taken my arms really wide and done a big arc that it just included everything. You know, it's like, you know, just somehow it's all-encompassing. And I think this being able to relax into the body is the beginning of this kind of waking up in the body. When people use the word mindfulness a lot, the word mind gets prioritized over the body, perhaps. And the word mind also then, I think some people, in the way it's taught mindfulness, it seems to point to a cognitive process. And so sometimes mindfulness is taught as a process of recognition. We have to recognize what's happening, recognize the breathing, recognize the sound, an itch. You know, and some people use, sometimes we teach using mental labels. It's a very effective practice to do that. I recommend it as part of the mindfulness training. But it does kind of point back to the brain, to the mind, doing this cognitive kind of processing. And but it begins, this whole cultivation of awareness in the Buddha's practice, with really focusing on the body. So what we're seeing here with this first exercise, what we're going to see is the Buddha lists a particular areas of our life that are particularly useful to cultivate attention, to cultivate some focus through, to get established in. He doesn't say, become aware of everything, as if everything is of equal value. It's certainly an effective practice to do that, to have no choice about what you pay attention to. Sometimes it's called choiceless awareness. But for the Buddha, it's not so choiceless. There's a particular choices of where you kind of bring your attention, what you focus on. And here in this first beginning is just breathing and relaxing. And then he talks about being aware of your body, being mindful, aware of it, as you walk around. Walking to and fro, when you sit, when you stand, when you lie down. Know your postures. And here he talks about doing two things, being aware of it and clear comprehension. And clear comprehension is more the cognitive side of the mind, where you clearly recognize what's going on. But it's not the only thing we're doing. We're cultivating awareness and clear comprehension. And awareness is something I like to suggest is much more embodied, that comes out of this relaxed body. And then he has a series of emphasis, ways of focusing on developing more and more attention to the body. The one that's a little bit, it's seldom taught when people teach mindfulness, and even I seldom teach it, but that is to contemplate corpses. And so the question is, how is it a contemplate, different states of decay? So it's a visualization, it's an act of the mind. And the question is, what does this have to do with establishing, as a way of establishing awareness, coming into awareness? I can't say what's going on in the ancient world, what the Buddha was thinking, but I know that for me, that when I spend time with people who have died or corpses, that I become aware of I'm in the present. I'm not very far away from the present moment. There's something very compelling, very engaging. I'm here, and the present and the contact with the idea that this, how precious this life is, how short it is, that I'm going to die. This kind of sometimes will kind of tune me in to being here, and when I'm really here, in this kind of heightened way, then awareness is here. Like things start becoming a little more luminous and special. It's like, wow, you know, I better be here, or I am here, or this is, I'm not going to take this for granted, this being aware, this being conscious. And the awareness is here. So it's a way of establishing awareness. I'm much more established in this kind of clear presence. So that's the first area that the Buddha talked about for establishing awareness. The second is something called feelings, in English, feeling tones sometimes, because it's not emotions as we think of it, feelings, but rather it has to do with three valences of sensations. Any sensation that we have can it be either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. And the pleasant and unpleasant for experience has a very powerful effect on our attachments, our desires, and our aversions. A lot of wanting and not wanting comes with things that are based on whether they're pleasant and unpleasant. So if we start becoming aware of how things are pleasant and unpleasant, the nature of it, we become much more easily aware of then also how, and if we're in our body also at the same time, you probably start becoming aware of how the body, the mind, lean or pull away. They tighten up when it wants something, or tighten up a different way when it wants to push something away or it wants to get away from something. There's a lot of information in the body that about our reactions and reactivity to the world that is available if we pay attention. And I find it been very powerful in my life to have sat in meditation every day for years and not moved. And I've started to feel and tune into all the ways in which my mind wants to move, all the ways my body wants to react, and subtle ways in which I want to pull forward or pull away or tighten up. And sitting there as attentive to the body and watching all this subtle reactivity has taught me a lot about how my mind reacts, how my mind has preferences and desires and aversions, and has taught me something very powerful, and that is to not give in to these reactions, to have a certain balance and presence without acting on them. But rather, and when you don't act on your desires, your aversions, your preferences for and against pleasant and unpleasant, it tends to put us back into stronger into a place of awareness, to be more aware. If we're always acting on our desires and our aversions, and we're always doing and going, it actually kind of eats up or collapses, or we lose some of our attention capacity in the focus on the object of desire or the object of awareness. But certain kind of awareness gets awareness gets freed up if we don't give in. It's kind of like the presence. It's like I don't know if this is a good example. Maybe it's like, but I think of it as the sand in the oyster, and the pearl is your awareness. And the awareness kind of gets stronger if you don't give in to the the irritation or the pleasure that's there. It gets more interesting here because the Buddha then, in his teaching about feelings, the feeling being pleasant or unpleasant, he says that there are two kinds of feelings. And some people translate this as spiritual and non-spiritual. It's probably not the best translation, but we'll go with it for now. And non-spiritual are just those sensations, the pleasant, unpleasant sensations, that come from how our senses are stimulated. So we see something, hear something, taste something. So that's called non-spiritual. The spiritual has to do with the deeper feelings that reside within us. Maybe the deeper emotions, a deeper sense of that which kind of belongs to our depth. If someone asks you, how are you really deep inside? Oh, you know, my life is difficult these days, but deep inside I feel very settled and peaceful. It's very pleasant in there. Or today was a really nice day, it was sunny, everything's going well in the world, but inside I just felt off. I felt kind of tender and sore and, you know, contracted. It didn't feel pleasant in there. So there can be a difference between how things are on the surface and how things are deep inside. And there are those sensations and those feelings inside that can be pleasant or unpleasant that has to do with something much deeper than what's happening in the moment for us. It's in the moment, it's in the present for sure, but not happening with, you know, what's happening in the world around us. So to tune into this deeper aspect of ourselves and become a caretaker of our inner life, the quality of our inner life, that's the direction which the Buddha is going in this teaching of the four foundations of mind, four ways of establishing awareness. And I think the shift from the just simply seeing the pleasant and unpleasant, we're seeing the non-spiritual, and then going to the spiritual, or the outer and the inner, is the beginning of movement towards taking care of the quality of our inner life. In the mindfulness of the body exercises, we're taking care of the quality of our body. And then we take a step closer in to the inner quality of life. Then the third foundation of mindfulness is being aware of the states of the mind that we have, the moods of the mind, the quality of the mind itself. And this is also, you know, part of our inner life. And if we want to be the caretakers of the quality of our inner life, the quality of the mind, the quality of the state or the mood that the mind is in is very important. And so what is the mood of the mind? And you can kind of feel sometimes, especially when it's dramatic, wide swings in the mood, the states of the mind. Sometimes the mind is quite contracted and narrow, and sometimes it feels very spacious and open. Sometimes it seems that the mind is dominated by desire, addiction, and lust, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it seems to be on fire with hatred and anger, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it just seems completely confused and kind of lost in its confusion, and sometimes it's not. And it becomes kind of the mood or the predominant atmosphere of the mind, these things. Also, it's possible to have the mind become concentrated and really feel like it's stable, composed, and here. It's possible to feel a state of the mind being quite expansive and open. It's possible to feel the state of the mind feels quite free, unencumbered by anything. So the state of the mind can be quite varied. And to tune into the state of the mind is part of this path of the practice, to be able to recognize the different qualities of mind. Now, some of you might not like this word mind here. The word that's translated as mind is citta, which can also be translated as heart. So now we can, instead of mind, we can say quality of heart. Is the heart contracted? Is the heart expansive? Is the heart stable and composed on itself? Or is the heart scattered? What's the quality of your heart? This, again, we're talking about this inner life. Not just whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, but something that's richer or more important than pleasure and pleasant and unpleasant. Yeah, we say mind states here in the West so much, we prioritize mind so much. Here, when you go to some of the countries in Asia where I've been to, and you ask the Buddhist teachers, or if they're talking, they're giving Dharma talks, and they start talking about this citta, what we call mind, they start tapping their chest right here. The mind, they'll say. some of them speak English. And they right here, in the mind, right here. And this inner life. And then, as we start becoming aware of the quality of the inner life, the mind, I think that, and take that seriously as something to be a caretaker of, this also tends to bring more awareness into the picture. Awareness becomes part and parcel or intertwined in the very feeling of a higher quality inner life. And the feeling of satisfaction or kind of spiritual pleasure that comes from having a higher quality awareness operating, moving, present within which going on can start becoming very compelling and grows as we become aware of this inner quality. Then as the inner quality starts becoming more sensitive to it and can recognize the shifts and changes with greater acuity, then we can start also seeing that it's not a random movement, this quality of the mind. It's not just, you know, chaotic and just, you know, somehow your mind rolled the dice and you were going to be grumpy today. But rather, there's forces in the mind that are operating. There's activities of the mind, how it operates, that can either kind of diminish the quality of the inner life or heighten it. So there are forces, there's the hindrances, which are forces of desire, forces of aversion, forces of restlessness and worry, forces of resistance and sloth, and then there's doubt. And it's possible to feel these operating and recognize them in the mind, and to feel how they darken the inner quality, how they limit it or contract it, and how a higher quality inner life or attention is not so available when we get pulled into these five hindrances. I think of them as black holes of the mind or of the heart. Black hole being a place where a star, the gravitational force is so strong that light gets in its vicinity, it falls into the star and never comes out. So if your awareness gets too close to your hindrances, the awareness gets sucked in. It gets preoccupied by the desires you want, preoccupied by what you know, the aversions we have. On the opposite end, on the opposite side, there's what's called the seven factors of awakening. And these are mental states or heart states that get activated as awareness gets stronger and stronger. Awareness, strong awareness that's uncontracted, a mind state which is open, expansive, is not caught in the hindrances, begins having giving space for these beautiful qualities of mind to begin to surface. And generally, it isn't so much we cultivate these, but we recognize them as they begin appearing and developing and coming. And I think of them almost as being qualities or aspects, dimensions of this lucid awareness. As the awareness becomes more and more lucid and open, there are these seven things. Mindfulness, or this awareness thing, sati, becomes more lucid. There's the ability to more clearly differentiate what's going on. The ability to differentiate things is really key for the movement towards freedom. Differentiate between what's pleasant and unpleasant, using these maybe unfortunate terms, spiritual and non-spiritual, contracted mind, uncontracted mind, being caught and not being caught. To be able to make these kinds of distinctions in finer and finer ways is one of the factors of awakening, one of the functions of this awakened awareness. The third is effort, the kind of a beautiful, lucid, engaged energy and engagement with what we're doing, the idea of being engaged. It's not uncommon as meditation deepens and the awareness becomes stronger for the whole body energy, the kind of chi in the body to arise and to be here flowing in a strong way. And then there is joy. Joy is a very important part of this path to freedom that Buddhism offers. And then there's tranquility, a deep sense of peace. And the tranquility here is a very embodied tranquility. The whole body feels very peaceful. And then there's samadhi. And samadhi, not just being concentration, but being a state of deep composure and stability. And then equanimity, a deep equanimity, it's one of the most pristine emotions you can have, this equanimity factor of awakening. And it's a simple way of understanding it is a mind which is not reactive to anything. No matter what happens, the mind's not going to move away or move towards it. It's going to stay lucid and open. But there's something about this non-reactivity and presence that feels so satisfying, so pristine, so beautiful to feel this equanimity. So, becoming aware of how the mind gets caught and how the mind stays free, the forces that enslave the mind versus the forces that free the mind help support the freeing of awareness. And awareness then becomes freer and freer, more here, more present. Then it becomes something we can rest in or dwell in or be in or walk in or just have it here. And what's nice about this, that I think is very important for many of us, is when we are doing mindfulness, if we think of mindfulness as something we have to do, we're supposed to be aware, we bring along a lot of baggage about being the doer, being the self, the person who's responsible. It's up to me, I have to do this, I'm a bad person if I don't do it well, I have to do this stuff. But when awareness is strong, there's no doer to awareness. Awareness just is. You know, my awareness, I guess, is my own, kind of. But I'm not going to take ownership of it. It's not like I'm going to keep it from you. You can have it. it's kind of here. I'm not saying it's, you know, not belonging to this apparatus that's here, but that part of the mind that identifies, that feels like it is the agent, the doer, that wants to evaluate, wants to be someone. All that is, the awareness doesn't belong to that side. Awareness can know all that, but awareness doesn't feel like it's part of that. It's just here in a non-self kind of way, in a non-identifiable way, or non-identifying way. And that's quite profound, because a lot of the ways in which people suffer have to do with the doer, the agent, the victim, the one who's experiencing things. And to begin shifting or loosening up, the idea of being the experiencer of our life makes a lot more room. And it makes a lot more room for us to act wisely. So there is a place for acting and doing. It isn't like we're supposed to just kind of be couch potatoes in awareness. But as we become more aware and this whole process unfolds, the key thing is we start seeing the movements of clinging, grasping, craving, the ways in which we grab on to things, and the possibility of not doing that. And so the more we can rest in awareness, the more we can rest and be stable here, aware of the body, aware of the feelings, aware of the mind states, aware of some of these operating principles, operating systems in the mind, and come to a point where we can just see the movements of the mind, grasping and not grasping. And if you really get centered in this practice of learning not to grasp, not to grasp, not to grasp, not to move, not to be for or against anything, just sitting here, sitting here, sitting here, it gives a chance for the mind, the heart, to let go in the deepest possible ways and experience the deepest possible peace. It doesn't mean you're never supposed to react or act again in the world, but that has to happen, right? But once you know a level of peace inside that's not dependent on the things of the world being a certain way, then it's a lot easier to act in the world with ease, because we're not depending on the world being, our happiness is not dependent on the world cooperating with all our whims. And I don't think there's many people who have been so successful getting reality to cooperate with all our whims. It's usually not a good recipe for happiness. So the four ways of establishing awareness, to cultivate and develop the capacity to stay centered and attentive to these four areas, the Buddha called the ancestral homeland. It's a place you'll be safe. And you'll be safe because you know a sense of well-being, you know a place of stability, that if a hunter comes along with pitch, you know, some of the most alluring possible thing that you could possibly imagine, maybe you don't need to rush up to it and stick all four limbs right into it. And it'd be very embarrassing if you also put your head in, because then I guess your butt sticks up and you show that to the world. So even metaphorically or figuratively, you know, liberation keeps your butt in the right place. So those are my thoughts for today. I hope that you stay in your ancestral homeland and find it to be a really valuable and meaningful place to live and be in the world with other people who are also living in that ancestral homeland of theirs. And hopefully we can all share it. So we have about 5 minutes. Do you have any questions about what I said, or comments, or concerns you'd like to ask?
Yes, you were talking about the distractions of the mind and how many hours we spend in front of the computer and then reading. And I had a moment of panic when I thought about setting aside one or both of those distractions and what would I do, basically. It's almost as if I didn't know how to just be anymore. And then a little bit later, you said something about choice. I'm not sure I quite understood it, but I felt a little bit relieved because I thought, okay, I do have some choices. If I did decide tonight to go home and not turn on my computer or pick up that book and experience whatever I would experience, that I had some choice about what direction I might go in. So that calmed me down a little bit.
Nice, nice. The thing that's it's very, very nice what you said, and the thing that stood out for me, I think you said something like, what am I going to do if I'm not lost in those distractions? Yeah. And it's possible to read, it's possible to be in the computer and not be lost in distraction. It's possible to be present and aware in a certain higher quality way than you are when we're lost. So it doesn't mean either or. So for example, you might, if you want to read something tonight when you go home, you might go and find what you're going to read and then sit down in your meditation posture. So you're a little more upright than you would be on a couch, for example, an easy chair, but just your meditation posture, and then sit up a little bit even straighter than you would then. Set your reading material up so you're kind of not collapsing into it. So you're sitting, you can sit up, your chest is open, maybe in front of you. And then with your body present and alert, and so your body is stable, and your body, if someone came into your house and saw you sitting there, say, wow, that person's alert, you know. And in that alert posture, try reading for a little while, for 5 minutes. And see what that's like, and see when you finish, what has happened.
Thank you.
Could you repeat the hindrances?
Yes. So we say there are five, but some of the categories are double. So that's why some people get confused. So the first is usually called sensual desire. Some people are a little bit interested in sensual desire to the point of distraction or something. Other people are, it's the second hindrance, which is aversion or hostility. Some people are a little bit interested in that. They get lost. That's their hindrance. The third is usually translated in English as sloth and torpor, but I think to get a sense of what this is, it's not ordinary tiredness, is to think of it as partly resistance. Resistance sometimes is a source of getting tired or slothy. And then the fourth is restlessness and worry. People translate different ways. For the Buddha, it was probably restlessness and remorse. But here in the modern world, I think more people have worry than they have remorse. So sometimes we say restlessness and worry. Restlessness and remorse. And then the last one, and they say sometimes it's the most powerful one, is doubt. Could you follow all that? Should I do it again?
That's fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I have a little book. I have a book on those hindrances if you want to read them. They're kind of like a practice study book for the, you know, for practitioners. And it's called Unhindered. So if you want to get into them well. Yes.
Hi, Gil. One of the things that brings me down out of my ancestral home and out of the trees, I guess, to be where the pitch is parenting. Is, can you do what you did for the distraction of reading and being on the computer for parenting. How do you interact with this for parenting? And I get caught in that. I know at one point you said you were helping your son study, or he had to study for a test, and you were like, can I help? And he's like, no, you're too calm. And and so I
walked away.
So you walked away. So I'm always in danger of sticking my butt up with when I'm parenting, because I get really thrown off, and I'm worried about them, and then I'm worried I'm not worried enough, and then I'm trying to be calm, and how do you, I don't know, any wisdom around that?
So I'll say one thing. Never say anything or do anything with your kids, towards them, in relationship to them, without having first taken at least one full breath. Just that. It doesn't take long to breathe in and to breathe out, but never say anything or do anything until you've done that one breath. Just that one thing will probably give you a lot more space, a lot more wisdom, a lot more clarity, and probably rather that you'll find you will say and do things in a way that is more meaningful for the kids. They'll pick something else up, because important children learn by osmosis, by the example of the parents. And if they see you not being impulsively reactive, impulsively saying things, but there's a little bit of space for something else to begin operating, they'll have space. So if I tell you all to go home, I mean in the way that I said today, your ancestral home. Thank you.